Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. Welcome back to Smart Beauty. Today I'm speaking with Catherine Bossom, founder of Yellow Flamingo Consultancy. Catherine spent over two decades on the inside of luxury beauty retail, starting as a graduate trainee at Harrods, where she worked her way up to becoming a member of the buying team before later taking up the helm as beauty buying manager at Selfridges, followed by becoming head of buying at Space NK. She has seen the beauty industry transform from pre-internet days where retailers literally traveled overseas to discover new brands to today's saturated marketplace where buyers are inundated with pitches. Now through Yellow Flamingo, Catherine works with beauty brands to help them understand what retailers actually want. And spoiler alert, it's not what most of you think. In our conversation, she reveals why brand story often matters more than product quality for that crucial first sale, why getting into a retailer like Space NK or Sephora isn't about who you know, and the harsh reality about what retail can and can't do for your brand's bottom line. We also talk about the personal catalyst that pushed her to leave corporate life and start her consultancy. Catherine was generous enough to share her personal story about how a really tragic family situation set her on the path to building Yellow Flamingo. What I really liked about Catherine, aside from her being a fellow single mum building a business, was her lack of self-pity, her determination not to be a victim of circumstance, and the idea that sometimes when life deals us the worst set of circumstances, it can really push us to take risks we might not otherwise have taken because we're already out of our comfort zone. So there's that mentality of, well, how much worse can it get? We might as well do this and see what happens. So really inspiring lady. If you're a beauty founder trying to break into retail, or if you're just curious about what really goes on behind the scenes in the beauty industry, this conversation will give you the inside track from somebody who's been on both sides of the buying desk, and also look at how adversity in our personal lives can really be the making of us. Let's dive in. So Catherine, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Lovely to be speaking with you today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've had quite a journey. What experiences stood out for you among that whole journey? Like, what do you feel was the most significant?
All significant for many different reasons. Mm. I guess for me, probably the most significant and the most shaping of my career was my time at Harrods. So, you know, starting as a graduate trainee many years ago, and then working in lots of different aspects, I think really shaped what my career has become. I worked for a very inspirational lady, the beauty director at the time, a lady called Marigay McKee, and she was hugely instrumental in shaping my future career. So yeah, I definitely think Harrods was something that shaped that. Beauty wasn't something that had even been on my radar before, I think, other than being a consumer. It wasn't something that I'd ever considered as a career. So yeah, I would say that Harrods definitely shaped that.
And what did you feel you learnt about the luxury beauty scene during your time there?
I guess it was about the importance of the customer. You know, I think Harrods is an exceptional retailer from that customer point of view. And I think learning about luxury beauty in that environment was, you know, hugely eye-opening. You know, I think in terms of either the levels of service that a customer would expect, or even down to, you know, the things that customers would pay for, I guess it kind of shaped what beauty luxury really meant.
Yeah, I mean, it is a really unique beauty retail environment, isn't it? I mean, do you think that's still the case given the changing landscape and the fact that more people are shopping online now?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, retail, whether it be somewhere like Harrods, Selfridges or Space NK, beauty is still a very experiential in-person experience. I think yes, online has changed how consumers shopped, but I think you can't get away from the fact that, almost 60 to 70% of beauty retail is still done in a store environment. So yeah, I do think that that experience in person is very important.
And then obviously you worked at Space NK, very different environment.
Yeah.
What were the main things that you learned during your time there, and how did it kind of contrast to working with Harrods?
I think it was about learning about different types of businesses, to be honest. I think in somewhere like Harrods, I guess my exposure to brands and how businesses were run was set at a particular level. Most of the brands that you were dealing with were corporate groups. It wasn't necessarily individual brand founders. Yes, you might have met the founder, but that was still, Bobby Brown at, Bobby Brown as part of Estée Lauder. And so I think for me, moving to Space NK really opened up my eyes to meeting the actual founders of the brands that were personally very, invested in them, whether that be, Sylvie Chantecaille or Sarah Chapman or Margaret Dabbs or Adam and Paul from Percy and Reed at the time. It was meeting those people, and I think it really opened my eyes up to a totally different world of business and what it really meant as a retailer when you were asking that person for something. It was very different than the corporation. So that was
Yeah,
definitely a
that's true.
huge learning curve for me.
And obviously, the type of brands that were launching and the way we shop for beauty at the beginning of your career was probably, definitely very different to the way it is now. I mean, what were the main changes and industry shifts that you noticed?
I guess, I'm so old that it was before the internet existed. So, when you were at places like Harrods and even at sort of, you'd literally have to travel overseas to see what other brands were doing and then be able to bring that brand, back to the UK. So I think those were definitely some of the biggest shifts that you started to see was the rise of the internet, and that was, the whole premise of Nikki starting Space NK. At the time when she started it, there was no internet, so she was going to the US and finding those brands and then bringing them back. So yeah, that was hugely transformative. And then I guess how brands started to present themselves really changed. Again, Instagram and things like that didn't exist. So retailers really were the place where you had to go to discover the brand. As a consumer, you would have been discovering it in magazines, blogs were just starting. People like Caroline Hirons and Jane Cunningham, with their blogs, they were just sort of starting out when I was at Space NK. So yeah, it was a very, very different landscape to now.
And obviously, Cult Beauty, when they started up, they were like one of the first retailers to really focus on that digital space. I
Yeah.
mean, was that cause for alarm at where you were, or were people hadn't really anticipated yet how huge online beauty shopping and indie beauty would become?
I don't think people had anticipated how huge beauty online shopping would become. I guess as a retailer, I was always taught, like I say, at Harrods, to everybody's got their own customer, and everybody knows if you know what you're doing in your store. Competition is a good thing. So I guess I've always had that mindset that if you know what you're doing and where you're going and what your story and what your message is, there's enough space for everyone. But yeah, I think everybody did really underestimate what online would do, either from a convenience point of view, but also the research and the access to information that the consumers would have. I think that has been a huge shift from retail in terms of, like I said, at the start of my career, the BAs in store were so knowledgeable versus the consumer, whereas now it's much harder. The BAs are obviously still incredibly knowledgeable because they're the experts, but there's so much access to information for the consumer from online that I think it makes it
Definitely.
a very different shopping experience now.
Yeah, people are so much more well-informed, aren't they? And they sort of do their homework and do their research.
Yeah, totally.
And I know you touched on brand stories, which is something very, very close to my heart and that I keep banging this drum about. But I think that a lot of the time, brand story gets forgotten about. People think, well, if they have a great product, that should sell itself. Yeah, I'm sure that you have similar views on
Yes.
that.
Yeah, no, very much so. And I think that was definitely what I learned at Harrods at the beginning, that the brand story and the execution and all the different aspects of how a brand is built is what makes an exceptional brand. Yes, clearly you have to have exceptional product, but the product isn't really the be all and end all. It's everything else around it that supports. You know, I always say a customer comes back to a brand the second time because of how great the product is. But maybe the first time a customer comes across a brand, it isn't perhaps the inside of the jar that's making them buy it. It's the story, it's the packaging, it's the exposure, it's everything else around it. So yeah, I really do believe that that's an incredibly important part.
Definitely online, because if they don't have a product in their hands to test, story is really the only thing they have to go on, isn't it?
Absolutely. And like I say, we're all so digital now. So, yeah, that story is incredibly important.
And you worked in PR at Kenneth Green
Yes.
Associates. I mean, how do you think traditional PR has changed? Do you think it's as kind of significant now as it was back then?
Yeah, I definitely think so. You know, I think that the fundamentals of PR and the commercial side of the business remain the same. It's about relationships, and it's still about that person to person, experience. So yes, I would say that, you know, and I'm not PR expert at all, but you know, and I have great friends who are, but the premise of what it stands for is still the same. Yes, the avenues around it now are totally different, whether that be online publication, influencers, TikTok, all sorts of things. But fundamentally, it goes back to great relationships. So, yeah, I'd say it's still equally as important. I wouldn't work with a brand commercially if they didn't have a PR and a
No.
communication strategy, because nothing's going to work commercially if you're not telling that story. So, to me, the two
Exactly.
things are integral.
And PR and story are kind of interlinked in that way, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And going back to beauty buying, because obviously you've been on both sides of the fence. So you've been in the role of the person that decides, you know, what gets to go on the shelves. And now in your, you know, with your consultancy, Yellow Flamingo, you help brands not just solely, you know, getting into retailers, but that's a big part of what
Yes.
you do. I mean, how does it feel being on the other side? And what were the things that kind of were most surprising part of that journey?
I guess it's a very different side. You know, I had great experience at retailers. I almost wish that I could go back to the retailers now and be on that side of the fence with the experience that I've had now, because, like I say, I think there are fundamentals about brands and businesses and how things are structured that you're maybe not necessarily taught in a buying environment. I think that I have huge admiration for all of the buying teams now, because the influx of brands that they are contacted about must be unreal. You know, it was very, very busy in my day, but I left, you know, traditional retail in 2012, so that's a long time ago. So yeah, I think for them it was just a daunting task to be able to think about what the number of volumes of brands that think that they can make it. And I guess that was part of the reason why I started Yellow Flamingo, was to help brands understand it's not as easy as I think sometimes people think. And having come from that retailer side, it's able to give that expertise to a brand to make them really question why they might want that retailer. Sometimes I think there can be a disconnect between, I want my brand to be here, but actually, is that where your customer is? And so sometimes I think from the buying side, that probably gets quite jarring and quite frustrating for the retailers, being inundated with the number of brands who think that that retailer is right from them, but they're maybe not, along with all of the other things that maybe a brand isn't aware of that you need to have to be successful in retail, because getting into retail is really difficult, but staying in retail and being successful is even harder.
Exactly. They think it's kind of the end of the rainbow, but they
Yes,
don't realize
totally
how
not. That's
hard
the
work
beginning, and
really
it's a
begins.
steep learning curve, and I think if you're not prepared, it can be brutal, because you know, retailers are, you know, there's so much demand, and space on shelf is such a premium that yeah, I think it can be a challenge.
What are the main things to bear in mind then, if that's the case, for brands that want to kind of not just get into a retailer, but stay put and, you know, stay on the shelves.
I think for me, it's again, it's It's a combination of lots of different aspects. It's thinking about your brand through obviously the lens of the consumer. So how is that consumer going to know about your brand before they get to the store? It's equally then thinking about your packaging and how, so when somebody stood in the store, how do they understand your brand? You know, what do they need to know about it? But it's equally about investing in the people in the store and the training. You know, training and education is a huge part of, you know, a brand success in a store, along with the marketing support that you'll need to deliver to that retailer, along with all of the marketing and PR and social aspects outside of that retailer to ensure that when I am stood in that store and I'm looking at, you know, a shelf of product, that I've got some of that brand recognition from, oh yeah, I've seen that brand here, or somebody's talked about it. You know, I think it's a combination of lots of different aspects.
I mean, some people say there's a bit of a naivety when it comes to going into retailers because I think some people assume that once you're in somewhere like Harrods, you're going to see, the sales soar and, the money rolling in. Whereas actually, it's more of a marketing exercise, isn't it? Would you agree that it's more about raising awareness? Because once you're investing in all the sort of PR and marketing like stuff that you've just described, and then also once the retailer takes their margin, you're not really left with much at the end of it.
I think it's about the brand being really clear on what they want to be in that retailer for, you know, and I think, you know, some of the things that we touched on earlier about the change in the landscape in terms of how consumers discover a brand, where they might want to shop it, you know, all of those things have really changed what retail brings to the pie, and you have to be clear on what you want that retailer's role to be. Is that retailer about brand awareness? Is it about positioning? Is it about experience? Are all of those things supporting your D2C business or the experiential piece? But I think brands would be naive if they think that retail is going to be the place that is, you know, without question going to deliver a huge amount of volume. Yes, ultimately that is the aim, but that might not be the aim of that retailer. And again, retailers have different reasons for wanting to work with different brands. Sometimes the retailer's motivation isn't about revenue. It could be about customer acquisition. It could be about brand awareness for them. It could be experience. It could be, you know, how does that brand help to solidify what that retailer stands for? So, and again, that's sometimes where the disconnect can come, because if a brand purely thinks that being in a retailer is just about the volume driver, then you've got to think about, well, who is that volume driver likely to be? And is that volume driver more likely to be a supermarket chain than a luxury department store? So again, it's just being really clear on what the reason is that you want to go there.
So I started seeing more and more luxury brands now being stocked in these, mainstream kind of retailers that I wouldn't have placed them in. Like I saw, I believe it was Byredo, and now on Tesco Online. I mean, that's wild.
I
What do you
think
think about
it's
that?
for me, like I say, I believe that if the brand is right, the consumer can discover you anywhere. And I think that people need, or brands need, to be really clear on the reason for that retailer. You know, it might be that Byredo is not going to necessarily take a huge amount of money, perhaps from being on Tesco Online, but the eyeballs that that brand will then get from being there might then drive their D2C sales, or because it's fragrance, it might really drive their sales, you know, somewhere else. So again, for me, it's just about what is the point? What's the reason that you're working with that partner? And if everybody's clear on that, then I think it makes sense.
Okay, so there isn't sort of an obviously wrong choice then for a brand.
I don't think there's ever a wrong choice. I think as long as you, as a brand, know what you're doing it for, and it's considered, it's well supported, it's well executed, that it makes sense to the brand, then no, I don't think there are wrong decisions, because I think that we all shop for a variety of places, whether that be our local supermarket to a high-end fashion boutique to vintage to wherever, you know. And for me, it's about that brand equity. If I understand that brand well enough, then I'll understand to a certain extent why they're distributed where they are.
No, that makes sense. And can you tell us a little bit more about what you do with Yellow Flamingo and your consultancy and the services you're offering brands?
Yeah, so Yellow Flamingo is like I say, it's born out of my experience of working with lots of different brands from a retailer side, and now wanting to help those brands understand how to join up the dots of growing your business to be commercially successful. So Yellow Flamingo works on lots of different projects. We have clients that we've worked with for a number of years who might be overseas and don't understand the UK market and want to know where to be distributed. So we can help them understand what the UK landscape looks like, our view on where they should be distributed, and then again, our view on what are all of those supporting functions that you need to have in place to make the brand be successful. So that's one thing that we offer. We also work with brand founders. It's kind of, I suppose I always say the other side of a brand founder's brain. So, helping them to think about the commercial implications of the decisions that they're making. And I think because we really, or I really believe that it's about all of those different dots that I talked about. So it's about the PR, it's about the story, it's about the packaging, it's about the training, it's about the experience of the brand. Sometimes a brand founder is the only person that is overseeing that part of a business. And if it's not their expertise, I think I offer, or Yellow Flamingo offers, that other point of view to be making sure that they're spending their money in the right way. Because, every decision that a brand makes needs to lead back to either brand awareness or commercial gain or something like that. So, we work with brands to help them navigate that landscape. Or we also work with brands who are, born out of being a D2C brand, and then they want to start thinking about retail. So again, we help them to understand what functions do they need to have in place, what processes do they need, what do they need to think about. I sometimes think that it's very different when you're shopping for a brand in a store than you are from a website. So, I've got one client at the moment where we're talking about what their Christmas gift sets will look like, and they're predominantly a D2C brand, so they'll show me the gift set, and I'm like, well, that's great, because you can have that box online with a picture of the products next to it. But when I'm a consumer in store, if I just pick up a box, I can't see through it to see what's in it. So, it's just, I suppose, always offering that other point of view and that guiding bit to help them make those right decisions.
And there can often be naivety if you're launching a brand and you're brand new to the industry. Can that be a challenge sometimes?
I think it's a massive challenge, but then I also say it to a lot of the founders, I sometimes think it's also their superpower, because I think naivety is brilliant in the sense of, I'd never launch a brand for all of the reasons that, I know how hard it is. And sometimes I think that having that naivety is good, because
What you don't know,
you
you don't
don't
fear.
know. So, but what I do think is really important, which is the work that I love doing the most, is, like I say, is helping to guide that to make sure that those decisions are made in the right way. But yeah, I think there's so much to navigate in our industry. There's so many things to think about from an industry point of view, as well as the customer. So yeah, but I just think naivety is good, because if you knew, you'd never do it.
No, I definitely wouldn't, having worked
No,
with
I wouldn't either.
you for so long. And I guess what you were saying earlier, that there are so many brands sort of coming through now and buyers are overwhelmed. I mean, do you think that if you are a founder, it's best to partner with somebody like yourself if they're going to ever have a chance of getting into a prestigious, a prestigious retailer like Space NK?
I mean, I would say yes and no. I don't necessarily think I don't have a magic wand any more than the brand founder would.
No.
I think the thing about working with somebody either like me or, lots of the other, business consultancies that are out there, is it's about making the brand be prepared. So I think for me, that the bit that I always say to the clients that I work with, it's not about me having that conversation with Space NK. It's about me helping you to you for you to have that conversation with Space
Yes.
NK, and I guess that's the bit for me that is the most important, because I don't believe, and people at retail can tell you otherwise, but I don't think it matters who is asking the retailer to look at the brand. If the brand is not right, then it doesn't matter whether it would be me trying to ask somebody that I've known for 20 years or not. It wouldn't matter. So I do think that a brand being prepared is the best thing. But no, I guess that's slightly contradictory because I run a business that does that. But I don't think it always needs to be somebody else. You just need to be prepared. And there are many clients that I've worked with who I've worked with behind the scenes, and then I've not then had any involvement with them going to the retailer. They've then done it themselves. But for me, it's about making sure that they've understood all of the bits that we've chatted about that they need to have in place so that when they get that meeting, whether that's through their PR agency, something they've done themselves, somebody else they know, that they're in that best possible place. What I would say to brands is, no, if anybody that says to you, "Oh, I can get you into this retailer," I don't think they're telling the truth because it's not, in my experience, it's not the person. And I know that from having been the buyer. The brand has still got to stand on its own 2 feet. And if it's not right for the retailer, it's not set up, it doesn't make sense, it doesn't matter who's asking, that it won't be successful.
And I know that every retailer is different and, things change and trends come and go, but is there a set criteria for what a beauty buyer, somebody like in a position like you were, is looking for
I
that
don't think there's a
changed?
set criteria. I guess the retailer is very clear on what their ambition is, who they're trying to attract from a customer point of view, what categories they want to grow, what's happening in the marketplace. I don't think there's set criteria other than the brand has got to be able to deliver, well, I mean, stock, but the training, the sampling, the marketing. I think the fundamentals of being successful are kind of the same. But no, there's no set criteria in terms of doesn't have to have a celebrity brand founder. You don't have to have X number of followers on Instagram or this or this. Again, it all goes back to what is that retailer looking for? And sometimes for a brand, you don't know that because you're not at the retailer. So, I think it's about reading up about that retailer, seeing like-minded brands that they stock, and again, understanding that retailer and why would they be interested in your brand? There'd be no point in trying to pitch a uber expensive product to a Tesco marketplace because that isn't their sort of, space.
Byredo did it, but
But oh, Byredo did, I know. Now I'm going to have a look at that. But no, sadly, there isn't I don't think anyway, a retailer coming on here might tell you something different. But no, I don't think there's a magic list of do these 10 things and then this happens.
For you, once you sort of worked in-house at these different prestigious companies, what really sparked the idea of launching Yellow Flamingo?
I guess I'd had some great mentors along the way, people like Tracy Woodward and Hilary Dart, who had worked, for themselves and done this sort of consulting thing. But I guess being really transparent, it was a very personal decision to go and work for my to go and work for myself. I think, my new husband at the time was, particularly unwell. And I guess it made me think differently about what was important. And so I think wanting to work for myself where clients were bothered about the outcome that I delivered, not where I was at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, I guess became the real catalyst to doing it. So it was quite a, I guess it was a, it definitely was a personal thing. Like I say, Nick had been diagnosed with a terminal illness. We had a young daughter. I guess most of my friends thought I was crazy because they were like, why are you going to give up your job and work for yourself? But my viewpoint was, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? I've already been told this about, this guy that I've, not been married to for very long. We've got a baby, so why not like quit my job and go and work for myself? Because what else could go wrong? So it was just that attitude of, okay, well, let's just give it a go and see. And Nick was incredibly supportive and was like, well, yeah, why not? So I did. And I think I often really reflect back on, I think had he not been unwell, I don't think I would have done it because I don't think I would have had the catalyst to have done it. And so I often think, oh, I wonder where I'd be working now, sort of within that corporate within that corporate environment. So yeah, it was definitely a very personal decision for me.
And thank you for sharing that. And I love
That's all
to
right.
speak to guests about how, what sort of personal like mindset sort of challenges they encountered or lessons they learned, because I think that business is personal, and I think that you
Yes.
can't develop your business without developing yourself. I mean, somebody said to me the other day, like, your business is only as big as your self-esteem, which I think is very profound. So what was that journey like for you? Like, what were the biggest kind of personal, like mental, like mind blocks you had to overcome or work through? And
I
when
guess
you
it was, my daughter was quite young at the time. She was probably three. Like I say, Nick was d dealing with a terminal illness, and we were travelling up from Sussex to the Royal Free Hospital, every 3 months for them to scan him to see how the cancer was progressing. So I guess for me, working was a great distraction, but it was also just a way of, like I say, the whole viewpoint was, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? We knew what the worst was going to happen at one point. So it was just a case of, okay, well, I'm just going to make the most of it whilst I can. And then he was so supportive of, look, just go and do what you want to be able to do. So he was at home looking after our daughter. So yeah, it was just that real catalyst of, okay, well, I'll just see how I get on. And I'm still doing it now. But like I said, without that fear, I guess, that my whole world, I know at some point, was going to drastically change, I wouldn't have done it, which to some people is ironic, because they'd say to me, oh, but don't you want the security of this? And I'd be like, well, no, because you can have a job at one point and get made redundant. I've always had my eggs in lots of different baskets. It's a real juggling act, but I guess I'm then in charge of my own destiny. And it also allowed us as a family to deal with an illness in a very private way, because my clients didn't know. Some people did and some people didn't, but I didn't have to ask anybody for time off work if he was unwell and needed to go to the hospital. I could just do it myself. And so it also enabled us as a family to be very private, I guess, about what was happening, because I didn't have to justify to my boss that I needed time off, because my clients, they, like I say, they just care about the work you're delivering, not where you are. So
But it's always a challenge, I guess, in the early days of building a business. I mean, how did you kind of navigate that with everything else that you had going on?
I guess, I don't know, I just did. I don't know, but I think the resilience of dealing with a terminal illness gives, well, certainly anyway, gave me just a very different framework, or just a very different mindset. Because, like I say, the only thing I could ever think of, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? Okay, I won't get any clients, and then I'll go and get a job. Because I guess on the other side of my life, like I say, we were dealing with things that you don't think that you're going to do when you've been married for 4 years and you've got a young child. So I guess to me, the work thing was, okay, well, I'll just try. I'd been taught at Harrods and Space NK all about relationships and networking with people. So I just continued to do that. And I guess I also had this viewpoint of, nobody really knows what's going on behind somebody else's facade. So for me, it was just, let me just try and do the best that I can for somebody else, because I don't know what they're dealing with in the same way that they don't know what I'm dealing with. So let's just do this and see what happens. It definitely changes you, because it changes your outlook on everything, whether that's down to something that happens with the school mums or this thing or that thing. You just think, well, it doesn't matter, because I've dealt with this.
No, exactly. And what sort of values are most important to you when running sort of Yellow Flamingo with that in mind?
I guess I just want to work with nice people, and I
Don't we
just,
all?
yeah, exactly. And I guess I just want to do a good job. I enjoy working. It's really important to me, but I just want to work with nice people and try and make a bit of a difference. And it doesn't matter if that's a tiny, small brand that is never going to take off and become the latest big thing, or is it working with a great retail, a really big retailer? I just want to work with nice people, because if not, I'd rather be stressed about how am I going to pay my mortgage than be stressed about, oh my God, I don't want to deal with that person because they're making me feel terrible. So.
I couldn't agree more. And people say things like, oh, well, we don't go to work to be liked, it's just business. But like I was saying, I think business is, it interferes with my soul, like dealing
Yeah,
with business
it
like that.
does. And I think because it's me, and you know, it's the same thing with you. When you're Yellow Flamingo is me. I've worked really hard and worked under some really difficult personal circumstances to build a hopefully a good reputation and things like that to me. So it's really important. It's a part of who I am. And I guess I've never wanted to have to be apologetic for that. But yeah, I definitely liked the anonymous nature of not. I don't want people to feel sorry for me, and I don't want people to feel sorry for me because I'm really, really lucky. And I'm not sure what Nick would think about me saying that, but I know that I wouldn't be who I am. My daughter certainly wouldn't be the child that she is. So I just have to feel lucky. And also, there are people that are far worse off than me. So I just have to be grateful for what it's taught me.
And what do you think Nick would make of where you are today and everything that's going on now with the business?
Well, I don't know. I think you'd be horrified that my hair was grey now, having grown out my natural colour. I don't know. I'd like to think he'd be really proud because, you know, it's a proper fully fledged business that has supported our family for, you know, the last 5 years since he died and beyond. So yeah, I think he'd be quite proud.
And what's next for you in the pipeline? Do you have any other kind of ambitions or places you'd like to take the business or evolve in any way?
No, I think I definitely want to continue in the same way that Yellow Flamingo is evolving, in terms of the clients that, you know, we work with and the services that offered. I guess I'd like to be able to find some way to do a little bit more giving back, whether that's through mentoring or, I don't know, different stuff, you know, like beauty banks. I guess that side of things, I'd love to be able to see how Yellow Flamingo could help. More. So no. And then I'd also love to find a way for Yellow Flamingo to be able to bring together a sort of a hub where, you know, experts can all sit underneath one umbrella that brands can find. Because like I say, no, there's no one person that makes a brand successful. It's a joining up the dots. So I've always
Exactly.
loved the idea of Yellow Flamingo being some form of umbrella brand to a house of experts that people can know. All right, well, actually, if I need this type of person, I can go to Yellow Flamingo and they'll help me find them. Because that's what we do anyway when we work with our clients. But I guess I'd love to be able to find some way to have that as a thing.
Yeah, it definitely takes a village to grow a business. I think
Yeah,
there's
it does. It
one
does.
to grow a
And
child, but I think
exactly, because
same.
like I said, there's no one part. I'm not the answer to everything. I'm just one part that can help guide all of the different pieces. So yeah, that's where I'd like to take Yellow Flamingo.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for
Oh,
chatting with
thank
me. It
you.
was an absolute pleasure. And
Thanks so much.
yes, really excited to hear what you get up to next. But thank you for
Yeah,
being on the show.
great. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes as it helps people find us. See you next time.